Today, we're going to talk about chlorinated chicken. With a warning, the episode starts with a gory description of the production process. And Israelis head to the polls just 5 months after the last general election. What process does a chicken go through before it ends up on someone's plate?
The modern chicken begins life on a farm. It's a particular variety of bird that's been highly bred to grow incredibly fast. It will be kept intensively in very crowded conditions, and the conditions mean that quite often disease spreads. When the birds are harvested or culled, they have workers come in, they inevitably panic a bit and they tend to open their bowels. They would be taken to an abattoir in crates. They're turned upside down and shackled, and then they're slaughtered. Most commonly now in the UK, they're gassed with carbon dioxide, or they have been dipped in electric baths, if that's still the method of slaughter used.
Oh my God, are you serious?
Then they will go through a scald bath to loosen the feathers. The water in that might not be changed very often because the whole economics of the system depends on getting them through at speed and great volume. Then they go through plucking machines, whirring fingers which pull out the feathers. That tends to squeeze the bird, so that's a point for contamination where you might get faeces being spread. And then they go through automatic evisceration, bit of the factory process where you get a sort of metal fist will punch out the innards, and there will be automatic slicing machines that take off the heads and the legs. They then go on to conveyor belts where workers will put them on trays, wrap them in plastic and put the labels on, and off they go to the supermarket. So there are various points in the production process that make it very liable to contamination. And that's just the nature of producing industrial chicken very cheaply, very fast.
Who would have thought that Brexit would have us talking quite so graphically about the production of chicken? It's a meat that has become symbolic of a key decision that the UK has to make after it leaves the EU. On the question of trade, standards and regulation, will we keep facing towards Europe or turn to the US, where there is one extra step when it comes to chicken?
At the end of the process in America, they're allowed to disinfect the chicken with various washes, including chlorine washes. And this chlorinated chicken has become totemic because it encapsulates the completely different attitudes to agriculture as a whole and food standards between the US and the EU.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, are we right to worry about chlorinated chicken? Felicity Lawrence is a senior investigative journalist for The Guardian, who has used undercover reporting to publish a series of exposés on the global food system. Why did chicken become such a hot political issue?
The Americans really, really want to get into our food markets. They've had this block from Europe, which won't accept their standards on lots of things. So a key thing for them about Brexit is that there's an opportunity to have a free trade deal with a large economy it's breaking off from Europe.
I spoke to President Trump this morning, your friend.
And to sell its produce to the UK.
You tell my friend, Prime Minister Boris Johnson, that we're ready to go to work on that free trade agreement just as soon as you're ready. The United States supports the UK's decision to leave the EU, and we're ready to build this economic relationship.
And chicken is one of those totemic things. It's a big industry for them. There's a big market for it here. The payoff for us is we want back other things. We want back sort of more access for our financial services. And so these trade deals are always a kind of tussle. And in European trade talks, the agricultural produce has always been a block for the Americans. So Brexit represents a huge, exciting opportunity for them.
And chlorinated chicken appears to represent a huge, exciting opportunity for the UK's media.
giving us chlorinated chicken in return.
Rule out chlorine washed chicken. It's a very simple thing.
There is no health issue with that.
Yes to chlorinated chickens or no?
No. I am sick and tired of hearing about chlorinated chicken.
We just can't get enough of stories about it. What is driving that?
It's become shorthand for all the things that people who want a different kind of farming, food and farming in the UK have against America. So it's not really just about chicken, but chlorinated chicken. You know, it's alliterative. It sounds horrible. You know, it's kind of reminds you of lavatories because we kind of disinfect our loos with chlorine. It's got a catchiness that has taken hold.
The government has been forced to address this. And recently, Boris Johnson made a pretty bad joke about it in Parliament.
But Mr. Speaker, I know he's worried about free trade deals with America, but there's only one chlorinated chicken that I can see in this house, and he's on that bench.
But what is their position when it comes to chlorinated chicken?
Well, it's not entirely clear. The Prime Minister Boris Johnson said to the US Vice President Mike Pence in a slightly jokey way,
"We're not too keen on that chlorinated chicken either."
Tory MP and former International Trade Secretary Liam Fox says there's no safety issue with American meat and it's just a question of welfare standards differing.
There's been no argument about food safety on chlorine-washed chicken. It's been an argument about animal welfare.
And there is indeed a welfare issue, but it is about health too. These food poisoning bugs are killed by thorough cooking, but there is a real problem with cross-contamination from raw meat before you cook it.
And on that question of health and whether there is a risk with chlorinated chicken, we've heard differing views here in the last week or so. What's been said?
The retiring chief scientific advisor to the Department for Environment and Food said American chicken and beef were perfectly safe, although it's not really clear what he was basing his opinion on. I don't think there's been any new assessment, and it's not his jurisdiction anyway. It falls to the Food Standards Agency. And then just last week, we had two leading food policy academics who said that the FSA had told them privately in personal communication that they were not sure that American beef and chlorinated chicken were acceptably safe. So I think it's hard to make a call.
And Donald Trump, like everyone else, has focused in on chlorinated chicken, suggested that it's all fine. How is he hoping to persuade people?
Well,
it's
he
okay.
Said he's going to invite some journalists to look at, I think there's a tender out from the American government for a contractor to identify certain useful journalists who can be taken around various chicken production processing plants and farms in America and see for themselves.
This has just got me thinking about that old Saturday Night Live sketch that's doing the rounds from years ago.
Cock-a-doodle-doo, folks. I'm Donald Trump.
In which Donald Trump is surrounded by people dressed as chickens.
Join me at Donald Trump's House of Wings.
Trump, you know our wings. We'll make you happy. Trumpy, you know our wings. We'll fill you up.
Is it going to be something like that? Do you want to go on Trump's chicken tour?
I'm not sure that I would get much out of it, nor that they would particularly want to invite me, given that I've investigated chicken processes so much and I've worked undercover in a chicken factory. And what you see on an official visit is very different to what happens when official visitors aren't there. I've got quite a network of workers I'm in touch with in various factories, and we always have a little chat after an official tour, and they say, yes, the lines were slowed down. Oh, that was you, was it? Okay, that's why it was also slow today. We were told we had to be very clean.
What is the actual difference between what happens in the EU and what happens in the US? Because you seem to suggest that most of the process is quite similar.
I think a lot of the processes are similar. They're similar globally. Both sides have got problems with food poisoning associated with poultry. I mean, poultry is one of the main sources of foodborne illness in both the US and in Europe. The figures are quite muddling and they are counted in different ways. So it's actually quite hard to compare them, although campaigners, again, on both sides have said, your chicken's dirtier than my chicken. No, it's not. Yes, it is. But it's very clear that there is a big problem in Europe and the UK. We've had a huge problem with a particularly nasty food poisoning bug called Campylobacter. And in America, they've got problems with Salmonella and E. coli contamination on eggs and poultry. It's not a clean industry in many ways. And you could clean up the system to a considerable extent if you slowed it down. If you changed the water more often, if you adjusted the machines more carefully in between different crops from different farms so that they actually fitted the precise size of birds. But all these things add money, slow it down. And so it's not the practice. The main difference is that it is a sort of attitude to it. The Americans worry less about trying to clean up the whole process beginning to end and fix the problem at the end by allowing disinfectant washes, chlorine washes or other disinfectants to be applied to the chicken at the end to try and kill the bacteria. The EU doesn't allow that, and it has been trying to work on cleaning up the different points at which contamination is a really high risk factor.
If I'm understanding this correctly, then the EU has two issues with chlorine washing of chickens. Number one, that it basically hides problems earlier in the process, because what you're saying is we can have really low standards and then we'll just give it a wash at the end. And number two, that people have concerns about the very act of chlorine washing and what it might actually do to the chicken itself. Is that right?
It's certainly true that there is a worry that chlorine or disinfectant washing at the end actually just hides the problems. And it also doesn't eliminate bacterial contamination. It reduces it. So you're relying on something that's not fully reliable. There is an issue with chlorination. That comes down to concentration. I mean, when you chlorinate something, for example, we disinfect water with chlorine at very low levels, and it leaves chlorinated compounds. Now, we know from animal tests that certain chlorinated compounds are cancer-causing. So the WHO, the World Health Organization, sets very strict limits on what levels of chlorine you can use in water. It's very dilute. And with water, it seems pretty clear the benefits far outweigh the risks.
What are the levels in water?
So the levels that the WHO recommends in water are a maximum of 5 milligrams of chlorine per litre.
And how much chlorine is in the chlorine washes for chickens in the US?
The US allows, from the academic studies I've looked at, chlorine up to 50 milligrams per litre.
Okay, so 10 times as much.
10 times as much. I mean, the truth is there's very little research on what kind of compounds are left after that I can find. It's probably not very high risk, but they haven't really done much work on it. So I think they just don't know.
It's probably not that high risk. I mean, are there other foods that we have here that are washed in chlorine?
Yes. The EU does allow salad vegetables to be washed in chlorine, which again is one of the arguments the Americans are saying, you know, you allow that, why are you fussed about this? But the industry's been moving away from them because consumers are concerned about them.
Right, so there is some debate about the actual risk of the chlorine itself, but the use of the chlorine wash after setting lower standards through the process does seem to signal a deeper divide between the US and the EU in terms of their attitudes to agriculture.
Yeah, I think the EU adopts what it calls this kind of precautionary principle, where rather than wait for everything to go wrong, it tries to apply best standards throughout the chain. So it will try right at the beginning of the process to make sure that it's got really good standards in place for, say, disinfecting the chicken sheds between crops. And at each point, they will be trying to have slightly higher standards. The Americans have a different attitude to regulation, which is, unless it's proved a problem, it's okay. The same applies to genetic modification. The EU is very cautious about it. And with new technologies now, you kind of get gene editing, which is slightly different, where you're not introducing different DNA, you're just editing the DNA. And Europe says, we need to test all that because we don't know what the consequences are. And America's saying, it's fine, we can go ahead with it. And if there are problems, we'll sort it out later. So it's a kind of, it's a philosophical difference in approach. And certainly when it comes to welfare, Europe has higher standards than the States. And the UK's been a leading force there, where I think people here care much more about animal welfare and want to know that it's applied across the industry. the Americans and free traders here would say, well, it's up to consumers to choose. They might want the cheaper thing, or if they want the better animal welfare, they can pay more, but they can choose. As long as it's labelled, it's fine.
Are there other areas that the EU regulates that the US doesn't?
Yes. I mean, the EU has much more stringent rules on pesticide residues in food. It has rules on chemicals and how they must be safety checked before licensing, which the US objects to. It allows hormone treatments to speed up growth in cattle. It allows certain drugs to be used in pig production that the EU doesn't allow.
Presumably those lower standards alongside cheaper land allow US producers to sell chicken, for example, at a much lower price than elsewhere. A lot of people would argue that cheaper food is a good thing.
The issue is one of food quality as much as anything. So the type of mass-produced chicken that they're talking about is the stuff that goes into highly processed foods. And the people who are arguing that we should allow this stuff to come because it will benefit poor consumers, they'll get cheaper food. We actually don't really need any more cheap food. What people actually need on low incomes is a decent income to be able to afford better food.
But people do have low incomes. We can't just click our fingers and give higher incomes. I mean, I remember a good friend of mine, I said to her, I try to buy free range chicken, not anymore because I've given it up completely, but she laughed. She said, I've got to feed a family of five. I can't afford free range chicken.
Well, I mean, I think
how
that's
do
right.
you persuade
no, I think
people?
That's right. Well, because if people can't afford good food, the problem is not to produce lower quality, ever cheaper food. It's to make it possible for them to afford it. People who are on low incomes suffer the most from diet-related diseases caused by poor diets. And making the food cheaper and ever more nutritionally depleted actually hits them hardest. Obesity hits them hardest. And the other thing is that there's this sort of strange notion, which has actually been fostered by governments, particularly going back to the war, that we must all have masses of protein. Now, if you're in a very poor developing country, you may be short of protein. It's exceptionally rare for people to be short of protein in this country. We eat much more than we need. So it's all based on false premises.
Do we need a complete attitude shift to take us back to a time when chicken was seen as a luxury good, so you just had it occasionally? It's not something you can feed your family every day.
The extraordinary thing with chicken is we've taken this bird and we've sold it as a healthy, low-fat meat and managed to produce this incredible shift in consumption where people are just eating it all the time in every form in a way that's completely new. I mean, it was not like that in my childhood or other people, you know, post-war. And the composition of the meat changes. So there is now less protein in the chicken and more fat because they're eating fast food diets. I mean, it's the same principle as when we are fed fast food diets. And there are fewer omega-3 long-chain fatty acids. So the things that people mostly are short of are missing from this kind of really intense production.
And if we did start importing cheaper US chicken washed in chlorine, do you think consumers here would buy it?
I think people say they don't want various things, but when push comes to shove, the price is all for most people.
And if it did happen, our own farmers would face a dilemma as well. Do they reduce their standards to compete with this cheaper imported US produce, or do they maintain standards so they can continue to export in the EU?
Well, I think, they'd be caught between a rock and a hard place, and I think they fear they would be out of business. Having said that, you know, it's not, it's an industry where there's a huge turnover, concentrations of power you're not talking about saving lots of little small farmers with this.
The chlorinated chicken debate feels to me incredibly symbolic of the choice that we face after we leave the EU, if we ever leave the EU, which is, do we keep facing towards Europe with more regulation in areas like agriculture, or do we turn towards a more kind of US-based model where we strip back standards in favour of cheaper goods. It feels right now like this opening to the US is what it's all about for people like Boris Johnson. I mean, do you get that impression?
Yes, very much. I mean, this is what it wasn't the main message from the Brexit campaign, but very much what they want is ultra-free trade, and they want to deregulate, they want a very liberalised system of global trade. And one of the things that they don't like about the EU is that it does take action on things, not just on food and food regulation, but it's coming together with the Paris climate agreements, it's trying to take action on climate change, which the Americans don't want to do anymore. These are all things that are great threats to certain parts of business, and things that the libertarian right, both in America and the UK, are deeply opposed to. So that's really what's going on with Europe.
Are there groups that are actively lobbying in this area?
This debate is worth so much money to people, and I'm being lobbied intensely by certain parts of American business, and there are key players in big food and big agriculture who are lobbying because this is a huge potential market for them.
Maybe you will go on the Trump tour then.
No, I think I've blown it.
Felicity, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
That was The Guardian's special correspondent, Felicity Lawrence, who, alongside her excellent reporting that you can read on the website, has written two best-selling books, including Not on the Label. Coming up, for the first time in its history, Israel is holding two national polls in one year. Now, despite already having had one general election this year, Israelis are again going to the polls today. Why? In April, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu came out ahead, despite facing a number of corruption charges, but failed to build a coalition government. So, second time round, can Israel's longest-serving leader hold on to power in this closely fought election? The Guardian's Jerusalem correspondent is Oliver Holmes.
Netanyahu has a long history of appealing to far-right nationalists during election campaign. And that sort of snowballs and escalates as you get closer to election day. Famously, in 2015, he warned that Arab voters in Israel were coming out in droves. And that was sort of seen as a dog whistle attempt to rally his base. This election has seen many incidents like that. He's also been proposing some ultra-nationalist agendas that have long been taboo around the Middle East peace process, and that includes annexing, i.e. taking sovereignty over a large part of the Palestinian territories. So he's really ramped it up in the past week or so. It's extremely divisive. Israel is a very diverse country in many respects. Almost a fifth of the population are Palestinian citizens of Israel, who are Palestinian Arabs who remained in their towns and villages around the time of Israel's creation. So there's a very, very large Arab minority. Netanyahu and his campaign's rhetoric has really created a massive division in society. The main rival running against Netanyahu in this election is the same man who was running against him in April. He's the former head of the army, a man called Benny Gantz. And he has run his campaign on, really, the campaign has been completely focused on Netanyahu himself. Gantz has talked about how Netanyahu has broken down democratic institutions in Israel, gone against judges, and so forth, and he's promising clean government. And that sort of worked in the April election. He did receive a lot of votes in his party, but not enough to form a coalition government. And this time he's focused on the same pledges. But what's interesting about Gantz is that he, ideologically, he isn't far off from Netanyahu when it comes to big picture issues. Even he said that it was his plan to annex part of the Palestinian territories when Netanyahu announced it himself. nobody wanted this second election. But the way that Israeli politics works is that it's extremely unlikely that one party will have a majority, and they have to make deals with smaller parties. And that gives smaller parties quite a lot of power. It's unclear if Netanyahu, who's Israel's longest serving leader, will be toppled in this election. When he was unable to form a government, at that point there would have been an opportunity for the opposition to try and form a government. But Netanyahu forced parliament to dissolve to give himself another shot. Nobody wants that situation to happen again. So there'll be a lot of pressure to form a government this time.
That was Oliver Holmes. Do follow his coverage of the elections today at theguardian.com. My thanks to him and to Felicity Lawrence. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.